I'm Chris Reback. This is BCRF Conversations, our series focusing on scientists, thinkers, and leaders who drive the insights and breakthroughs of breast cancer research. Among the many challenges with breast cancer and breast cancer research is metastasis, when cancer cells break away from a tumor and travel to distant parts of the body. Within this collection of cells is an important minority group, breast cancer stem cells. These cells are ultimately responsible for cancer-related death in women with the disease, and understanding how they work is central to much of today's research. At the forefront of that research, Dr. Michael Clark. Dr. Clark is a professor of medicine at Stanford University and, since 2005, a BCRF grantee. He's also the Carol and Avis Bikas Professor in Cancer Biology and Associate Director of the Stanford Institute for Stem Cell Biology and Regenerative Medicine. In 2003, Clark's lab was the first to identify breast cancer stem cells. Since then, among other findings, Clark's team has identified two genes critical for stem cell functions, including a gene that regulates normal stem cell dormancy, which can drive the unpredictable length of time when tumor cells exist quietly without clinical manifestation. It's one of the most pressing problems in breast cancer, responsible for late relapses. What's next from Dr. Clark and his lab? What ideas is he exploring that might help prevent relapse? Dr. Clark, thanks for joining me. Before we get into the specifics, I'm always curious, why research? What was it about scientific research that once upon a time said to you, this is where I can make a real difference?
Well, as you can tell from my academic appointment in the Department of Oncology, I'm a board-certified oncologist. And when I was seeing cancer patients, what I realized is, although we do well and we're clearly making advances in cancer treatment, we really needed to do more. And I just realized that by doing research, in the end, I might have more impact on patients and how they do than I would taking care of individual patients as a full-time clinician. And luckily, one of my mentors at Indiana was a fellow by the name of Larry Einhorn, who figured out how to cure testicular cancer. And I was a fellow with Larry, or a resident with Larry, actually. And Dr. Einhorn pulled me aside one day and said, you should really go into academics. And he said, you should either do bench research or basic science or clinical research. And he said, either is equally important, but you should concentrate on one or the other because we need both. And he asked me, well, which one do you want to do? And I said, well, Larry, I think I'm a little bit biased towards basic research. And he said, I totally understand, even though Larry is a clinical researcher. And so he helped facilitate my getting a good fundamental basic science training so I could go into primarily bench research. But clearly, my bench research is geared to try to understand diseases, and breast cancer is one of the major things my lab studies, and how understanding basic mechanisms can be used to improve treatment for women with breast cancer.
So to talk about your work today, I think it really helps to understand exactly what you discovered and analyzed starting in 2003. Why was it such a breakthrough to identify breast cancer stem cells?
Let me explain what led to the discovery and what I understood. And it actually goes back to my training with Larry Einhorn. So when I was at Michigan, I was taking care of patients with testicular cancer. And as part of that, I used to give lectures to medical students about germ cell tumors. And I was giving a lecture. There's two types of germ cell tumors. There's mature teratomas, which are benign. And as the name applies, they're cancers with mostly mature cells, or all mature cells in them. And then another type of cancer, which is called immature teratoma, which is malignant, metastasizes, and behaves as a very aggressive cancer, as opposed to essentially a benign tumor like mature teratomas. So I had a patient that I treated using the regimen Larry Einhorn really came up with, who had immature teratoma. And basically, when I treated that patient, his tumor shrunk, but he had residual tumor. And when we took that tumor out, it had converted, or it was consisted only of mature cells. And that patient was cured. And that was the teaching point, that when you give platinum-based cancers, you can have residual tumor masses. But if it's all mature cells, most patients go on and they're cured. So as part of that teaching point, I showed the slide of his original tumor, which was an immature teratoma. And when I looked at that tumor, what I noticed, to my surprise, was it wasn't all the cells that were immature. It was just a minority of immature cells, really in a bed of mostly mature tumor cells. And the dogma at the time was that platinum-based therapies caused the cancer to differentiate. But what I realized what was probably happening is that platinum in testicular cancer was killing the immature cells, and that patients could live, could be cured, even though they had some residual cancer left behind. And then what dawned on me is, well, if this is happening in testicular cancer, it probably is happening in other solid tumors, which also, at the time, most people didn't appreciate it, but almost all cancers arise in organs or tissues that have stem cell populations specific for that tissue. So since testicular cancer, we already had a drug that hit the stem cell population, I thought, well, there's no reason to really go after testicular cancer, but let's look at another cancer. And I decided on breast cancer because it was a major problem with unmet need. And so I went to Max Wischer, who was at Michigan and was head of the cancer center then, told Max, and he was taking care of breast cancer patients, and I told Max, and I said, Max, I think breast cancer is a stem cell disease, or has stem cells, but need to prove it, and you're seeing patients, can you get tumor material for me? So Max thought about it and said, that could be a good idea, and started getting tumor samples to my lab, and we did stem cell biology, and we asked a very simple question. Could all the cells in the tumor, did they all have stem cell properties, or was it only some of them? And to make a long story short, and we studied at that time, it was mostly estrogen receptor positive tumors. In fact, the first study, it was all estrogen receptor positive tumors. What we found is in 8 of the 9 tumors we looked at, they indeed seemed to fit stem cell disease, and that some of the cells could give rise to tumors, and some of the cells didn't. The cells that could give rise to tumors had all the characteristics of immature mammary epithelial cells, and they could give rise to cancer cells. So that's basically how the discovery was made. And the reason I felt that was important is, again, going back to testicular cancer, if it's a subset of cells that behave like stem cells, then you have to understand what those cells are and what makes them tick. In other words, what enables them to behave like stem cells in order to try to find drugs that will attack that population, just like we have drugs in testicular cancer. And so that was the rather naive reasoning behind the initial discovery and why I wanted to understand what's going on, and basically to understand what the self-renewal machinery, in other words, the machinery that stem cells use to make more stem cells in the cancer cells. And the other half of my lab studies self-renewal machinery in normal stem cells at exactly the same time. Angie Park in the lab discovered the first gene that drives self-renewal of adult stem cells in multiple tissues. And so, again, the lab was already geared to study self-renewal and how stem cells drive growth of an organ, or in the case of cancer, abnormal growth. You can consider a tumor as an organ. And again, by understanding the similarities and differences between normal and cancer, I reason could probably give clues that would have therapeutic impact.
It's fascinating to me how connected the various areas of cancer research can be. I've heard this from other scientists as well. And in your case, you call it naive. I don't think others would agree. But it was having the insight and ability to connect what you were seeing in the testicular cancer world and thinking, wait a second, where else can I apply this? And you chose breast cancer. And so what was that like for you when you were the first to identify breast cancer stem cells? I mean, I can't imagine that after so many years, what that moment is like.
Well, you know, when you make a fundamental discovery, and truly fundamental discoveries happen every 5 or 6 years for even the best people, when there's a fundamental discovery that me and my lab makes, it's elation, and it's more like you see something, and when you first see it, you realize that no one else in the world knows this at this point in time, and you realize the importance. You know, when you make those discoveries, you know that when they're put out to the world, other people are going to work on them, and they're going to be able to use those discoveries to build on them and go forward. And if you go back to my original statement, why I did what I did, what really drives me in the end is I love fundamental discoveries. I was a really, really good chess player when I was a kid. I loved playing chess. So I love those kinds of intellectual games. But really what drives me in the end, I want to see these discoveries lead to benefit for people that suffer from the diseases I'm studying. So it's a combination of elation from making the discovery, but also realizing that this might be a piece in the puzzle that will improve people's lives. And in the end, if I can look back like Larry Einhorn and say that I've done some stuff that helps people, you know, that's ultimately what will make me happiest. And in a related disease, we just had a New England Journal paper on colon cancer stem cells. And after we found breast cancer, we looked in colon cancer for two reasons. One, we wanted to see, is this a common model in epithelial tumors? And the second is to try to understand if common mechanisms are being used by different cancers. So in breast cancer, let me back up a little bit. In breast cancer, about 10 years ago now, we showed that measuring the number of stem cells in a tumor, that the more stem cells that are in a tumor, the poorer prognosis. And that makes sense because the more cells that you have in a tumor that can drive metastasis and new tumors, the worse off you would expect someone to be. And that, you know, and that's that was the hypothesis. Turned out to be true in breast cancer. So flash forward, so we're applying the same principles to colon cancer and using advances in what we knew about stem cell populations and also a novel bioinformatics approach somebody here at Stanford, Debashi Sahu, developed, and then using markers for colon cancer that Pierre Delerba, who's now at Columbia, discovered while he was in the lab, we were able to refine the ability to count stem cells more accurately in tumors. And we were able to show in colon cancer that if you had about 5% of tumors were predominantly stem cells, had a very high cancer stem cell frequency. And so you would predict that those would be very, very bad actors, even in early stage colon cancer. And we found that indeed that was the case. And then what we did is we said, okay, what happens if these very early stage colon cancer patients who are not being treated with adjuvant therapy, what happens if they were treated with adjuvant therapy? And we found out, lo and behold, they actually benefited and there's actually increased survival. And so basically what that shows is that by using the stem cell biology approach, we probably have changed treatment of a subgroup of patients with early stage colon cancer who actually are cured with adjuvant therapy. And so that's the first example I know of stem cell biology actually being directly useful for clinical decisions that change therapy that save people's lives. So we immediately, when we saw that, we applied exactly the same tools to look at breast cancer. And preliminary data suggests we may have a gene that will do the same thing in breast cancer, predict patients who are going to respond to therapy. We need to validate that, and that's one of the things we're planning on doing in the next couple of years is the preliminary data looks very, very promising, but we need to go in and validate that. And I'm talking with other members of BCRF to get the material we need to see if what worked in colon cancer also works in breast cancer.
Is that what's key to making these fundamental discoveries that you mentioned, the ones that are really groundbreaking? I mean, look, by your math, if you do it all well, and I'd assume with a little bit of luck thrown in over a long career, you may have 5 or 6 or 7 fundamental discoveries. It's incredible, but it's not like there's one a year. They take time. But you also seek to connect these ideas and discoveries, whether it's from an area that you've been working on or someone else, and find ways to connect that research.
Exactly.
And I know from other BCRF conversations, that's such an important part to making a real breakthrough. I mean, do I have that right? As we think about finding preventions or actionable treatments, not just for breast cancer, but really any kind, is that detective work, taking what you might see or learn from one area of research and really considering how might this apply to what I'm working on next? Is that key for any researcher to understand? I'd imagine that's not so easy to realize, and not so easy to realize which ideas or which discoveries actually transfer and which don't.
I think some people realize it and some people don't. It's like everything in life. I think some people understand this and other people don't. Part of it is in the way we're trained as oncologists. So there's certainly things in the breast that are different in the colon. For example, how estrogen and progesterone works is much different in the breast, obviously, than in the colon. But when you start looking at the nuts and bolts of the cancer, there's much more that's shared than different in the breast. And so I think what I'm learning is there's a lot of similarities. You know, if I were to put a rough number on it, the similarities between breast and colon is probably in the order of 80%. But there are things that are fundamentally different. It's important to understand what's the same and what's different, number one. And it's especially important for me because with stem cell biology, if you're attacking a fundamental stem cell program, and we've done this in breast cancer, for example, and that same program is being used by critical normal stem cells, for example, the intestinal epithelium, if you can effectively eliminate the cancer cells by hitting some of these critical stem cell self-renewal pathways, but you also eliminate normal gut stem cells frequently. And if you do that, the patient's dead in 3 to 5 days because their gut is gone and they're bleeding, they're vomiting blood, they're, you know, passing blood through their rectum. They've got all the bacteria in their gut is now in their bloodstream and they've got infections that you can't control. It's just ugly. And so by studying these two different systems, I also study normal breast epithelium and normal colon epithelium. And right now, one of the more exciting things in the lab is we've got a stem cell program that the breast is using one component, but the colon is using a related gene, but not the same gene. when you knock out the breast gene, the gene that the breast stem cells are using, including, it looks like, the cancer cells from our data, the animal lives, and so the toxicity is theoretically tolerable. If you knock out the gene that the colon is using, it's lethal. And so if we can get a specific inhibitor to the breast gene, then we shouldn't be killing the colon epithelium. And so, again, there's similarities in that they're both using the same pathway, but they're using different genes to activate the pathway. By understanding these really fine details, for me, that's the holy grail, is figuring out things in the breast that aren't going to eliminate the normal colon, the normal skin, brain stem cells, blood stem cells. The holy grail is finding something that does that. And so that's the reason for studying the similarities and differences of these different tissues.
You know, in listening to you now and throughout this conversation, it occurs to me that I can completely hear the chess player in you that you mentioned earlier. I don't think you've lost that gamesmanship. I mean, we hear about how great chess players, the masters, are thinking not just one move ahead, but multiple moves ahead. And it seems to me that that's what you've done, from testicular cancer to breast cancer to colon back to breast. And it's also clear that a recurring theme for you and an area that you've come back to in your research is relapse. I mean, it's driven so much of your previous work, and it's central to your current work. Why is that? Is it just that that's where your research took you, or is there something about that aspect of this terrible disease, the incredible challenge that anyone would surely feel after beating one round of cancer, only to relapse into a second round?
Because that's what kills people. And that's the chess game I'm playing. As you said, the chess game I'm trying to play is to figure out what's driving that. And the hope is to find a way to intervene that eliminates relapse, but doesn't get rid of normal stem cells and kill someone. So that's the chess game. Is clearly stem cell programs are involved in relapse, in many types of relapse. I'm not going to say all. That would be stupid for me to say that's always the case, because I'm sure there'll be examples where it doesn't. But it clearly, to relapse and kill, you have to have the central property of a stem cell, which again is self-renewal, regenerating itself, retaining its proliferation capacity. The holy grail is to perturb that process in cancer cells so those cells no longer relapse. And while you don't do that in normal stem cells, or at least critical normal stem cells. And so the whole reason for concentrating on the relapse is that's what kills people. The primary tumor in reality doesn't really kill anybody, or very, very few people. It's, you know, it's rare nowadays with the early detection. You can eliminate local disease pretty well, but it's the relapse which kills people. And so that's why I'm interested in relapse, and extraordinarily interested in the cells that resist our standard therapies, the therapies that people get for regular treatment. I just saw an article yesterday that women with estrogen receptor positive patients who have been treated with adjuvant therapy are still, you know, anti-estrogens are still relapsing 20 years later. Well, I guarantee you the reason they're relapsing is because the cells I study haven't all been eliminated by definition. And again, that's why I'm so interested in why are these cells resistant to our therapies. And it turns out that many of the ways that they're resistant to our standard therapies are actually programs used by normal stem cells to protect themselves from stresses. Because if you eliminate a normal stem cell, say you eat some toxic substance that's toxic to your gut, if you eliminate all the stem cells, you die, period. That's the end. So stem cells have actually generated mechanisms to protect themselves from toxins. And also, immune therapies are very very popular right now, but a lot of these protective mechanisms against the immune system are actually, they don't just pop up in cancers. They actually are used by normal stem cells to protect themselves from the immune system. And so a lot of the resistance we're seeing, and again, it's not going to be all, but a lot of the initial resistance we're seeing when people aren't cured, these are normal stem cell programs that the cells are using to protect themselves. And so the key is trying to understand those and figure out if we can intervene again in the cancer to overcome them.
And I assume, like any chess master, applying the ability to think several steps ahead and several moves ahead and not just the immediate move. Well, Dr. Michael Clark is professor of medicine at Stanford University, the Beekes Professor in Cancer Biology, and associate director of the Stanford Institute for Stem Cell Biology and Regenerative Medicine. He's been a BCRF grantee since 2005 and really connecting so many areas of study across so many areas of cancer. Dr. Clark, thank you so much for your time. I'm Chris Reback. This is BCRF Conversations. To learn more about breast cancer research or to subscribe to our podcast, go to bcrfcure.org/podcast.